You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In his latest book, One Big Box of Paranormal Tricks, From Ghosts to the Theory of Just One Paranormal Power, John Fraser reflects on his motivations for his involvement in paranormal research from an early age. The book is less of a life story and is presented as a meditation on what the paranormal may mean for us. But before we join John, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Thank you to my latest patron, Sarah, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show with your contributions. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our merchandise site is available exclusively via TeePublic, and you can find the link in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Let's join John as we peer inside the paranormal's box of tricks. Strange phenomena has baffled many of us for centuries, causing consternation and frustration for investigators and researchers. Can paranormal events really be shoehorned into separate categories, or is there one overall paranormal power that seems to be pulling the strings? Returning to discuss this intriguing theory is the marvellous John Fraser. John, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
It's a pleasure to be here, Paul.
It's lovely to have you. It's always nice when a guest says, "Can I come back?" That's always, I take it as positive news to receive such a message, John. And I was delighted with your latest book hitting the interwebs for people to pick up, that we can have another conversation about some of the wonderful topics included in this, along with all kinds of strange and wonderful things, thanks to your fabulous career in the pursuit of the paranormal, sir.
If only it was a career. more spare time and passion. I do have a day job like most of us.
Yes, yes.
In fact, apart from the people that go running around screaming sometimes on TV, I suspect there's very few people have a few full-time occupation investigating the paranormal. Outside of parapsychology labs, of course.
Absolutely, absolutely. Such is the shame that often some of the best researchers have to supplement their interest with dealing with the reality of the world, as I do as well, John. So I know I share your pain, sir.
Nope, we have pain shared.
I mean, looking into this new book, John, it's intriguing for me because these are some of the theories and thoughts that have often crossed my mind, I think. Because I think one of the frustrations of having an interest in this particular topic, and this falls on both sides of this, I think, is that you will have people who will try and categorize various paranormal phenomena into separate categories. And it's very interesting that certain researchers will not deal with any kind of case that cross-pollinates say, from ufology to cryptozoology to ghost hunting and the paranormal and strange behaviors and weird events and inexplicable occurrences. And then sometimes you will find these cases where you can't say it's really a ghost, and you can't say it's aliens, and you can't say it's time slips or something like that. It seems to be a little bit of everything. And sometimes what I've learned over the years is that there are some researchers that, even if they deal with weird phenomenon, sometimes it's too weird for them to deal with, and they either ignore it or they'll pass it on to somebody who they think will be able to deal with this a bit better.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is probably the idea that might be one overriding theory of the paranormal probably is by no means new. I kind of came across it again when I was writing my book on poltergeists a few years ago, when I discovered, I looked into cases, that poltergeists and certainly apparitional ghosts seem to invariably be one and the same thing. Then it got even more interesting, for my luck, I've been to Transylvania 5 or 6 times and mixed with folklorists and some academics over there. And most of what they might have described, at least historically, of being vampire cases, started to sound incredibly like your average poltergeist case. It's just that they have a vampire mythology and we don't. So they seem to describe unusual, possibly evil, even though they're probably almost certainly not evil events, as vampires. Well, we tend to go for headless horsemen or more recently evil black monks. So from all that, I started to think, I mean, if we're ever going to make any progress with the paranormal, I mean, anytime there's a scientific breakthrough, it's on one theory. And yet with the paranormal, we're kind of subdivided into witchcraft, occult, white magic, black magic, spiritualism, ghosts, poltergeists, vampires, shamans. And are we really talking about different things? Are we talking about the same power that is as yet not totally quantified and as yet not totally discovered? But that's where I kind of got to after writing my last book, and then lockdown came and I had a lot of time to think about it.
I think for me, one of the surprising things that I've noticed since I've started doing this show, which will be 6 years in March next year, John, is that having got to know so many people from across the world in different aspects of it, dealing with all kinds of strange phenomena, the one thing that I've noticed, and I think often when we talk about discussing such theories and ideas and thoughts that permeate these strange events, is that often people will point to skeptics and debunkers and say that they are cast iron in their disbelief of these particular subjects. And I think often people overlook that on the believer side, depending on the particular phenomenon we discuss, John, some people will be absolutely adamant that something is their kind of phenomenon. And I've seen this when people have been talking about UFO encounters, that people will say, well, the witnesses are wrong, they met fairies. Or UFO researchers will say, they didn't meet a fairy, they've met an alien. Or a Bigfoot researcher will say, well, the UFO incident that's going on at the same time as this alleged sighting is nothing connected with it at all. Or somebody else will say, oh, well, they're clearly definitely connected and that proves Bigfoot's an alien. And I find that as frustrating, because often, John, the problem I find sometimes with these researchers and investigators, if we can call them such terms, is that they are so cast iron in their beliefs that the witnesses' event seems to have no bearing on whether or not they believe them or want it to be real.
Oh, absolutely. I'm now getting pictures of Bigfoot flying a flying saucer, which would be interesting, I must admit.
Absolutely.
although, as I supposedly come from another dimension, that might be a bit tricky. No, quantum mechanics might allow for that as well. But no, I totally take your point, Paul. But first of all, I would, to some extent, separate out cryptozoology, possibly with Bigfoot, more likely with the Yeti. I mean, it's possible we could actually be talking about an undiscovered animal within the scope of our current science that has simply yet not been discovered. So I'd be wary about putting Bigfoot into that box. He probably wouldn't fit anyway. But no, the general point's true. People seem to come at the paranormal from a preset set of beliefs. The best, most recent one, and it is surprisingly recent, probably certainly this side of the Exorcist, is demonologists. Why bother investigate? You've answered the question by your title. The paranormal is indeed demons infesting the environment. Otherwise, why would you call yourself a demonologist? I actually mentioned in my book that I'm not a great fan of demonologists. It's not so much that I absolutely discard the Judeo-Christian notion of there being demons, but even if there's a chance they might be correct, you do not want to be knocking on somebody's door who's already having some strange phenomena, saying, "Hello, I'm a demonologist," because it's likely to scare them witless. And as stress and poltergeist phenomena are related, it's likely to make the whole thing worse. So yeah, people do come up from various types of beliefs. Obviously, the main split is between those who believe such phenomena is created by some afterlife entity and those who believe it might be powers within us, or those who believe it might be powers within us acting like a catalyst, a TV aerial for some kind of outside entity. But to start giving it names over and above that is pure cultural indulgence. It's absolutely fine for, you know, fireside discussions, but not if we're going to get to the truth of the matter.
I think it is very interesting that you can draw a line, as you refer to there, pre and post Exorcist, John. That the vast majority of ghost hunting expeditions, investigations, books, the word demon is barely mentioned in anything sort of from before the early 70s. And then you can see the cultural shift, primarily to notorious investigators, I would suggest, were one of the clear promoters of this particular strand of it, because it's very interesting, especially then, because they don't mention demons up until about 1973. A cynical person, John, would suggest that they were just tapping into the zeitgeist. However, some people cast eye and believe everything that those particular investigators did, even though there are numerous essays and counterpoints to sort of pull apart most of their more famous cases. And it, for me, it as you say, it's very cultural. It shows a cultural bias, because I think if you're going into a situation, regardless of the phenomena that you're attempting to solve or uncover, or at least have a kernel of truth as to what's going on, if you're going in there with a pre-planned framework of what you think is going on already, straight away the witnesses are having to fit inside what you want it to be rather than dealing with it. And that, I think, is, and we can all be conscious of this. I mean, we all try and be balanced and we all try and be open-minded, but we've all got preconceived ideas about certain things where if we hear anything outside of what we are, as supposedly very open-minded people, John, would consider the possibilities, even if we're not aware of it, there's always some form of unconscious bias tapping away at us that we really have to be careful not to let it override us without even realizing it.
I mean, we all have our favourite hypothesis as to what causes various aspects of the paranormal. we can't set that aside. We've all been brought up in a certain way. We've all got our own religion, or agnostic, or atheism, or what have you. All I would say is, don't put it on your calling card, and don't approach an investigation without being open to other possibilities. Otherwise, you get the absurd results where, I mean, it's not just it's not just in America. We get a particular zeitgeist pushing it in a particular direction. I mean, let's look at the Black Monk of Pontefract. How did it possibly become a black monk in haunting a council house, 1950s council house, built on licorice fields?
Yes.
It's, I believe one of the original researchers, Tom Cunniff, thought he'd read something about it in a book nobody else can find. But over and above that, there's about as much chance of it being a black monk as the eighth haunting of Anne Boleyn. I think she does seven.
Yes.
But nevertheless, we know, well, it's a wonderful English zeitgeist, black monks, because they're absolutely everywhere. And it's not quite as leading or scary as demonology, but nevertheless, it is rather distracting. Why can't we just admit there are strange things going on, try to quantify them, but without giving them a silly name?
Very true. And I think this is often one of those archetypes or cliches that can often occur. We've got one very similar here in Sheffield, John, with the Stocksbridge bypass, which has become a black monk.
Really?
Yes, even though the original report, the workman who reported it, which started the whole furore over it, claimed to have seen a shape or a figure that looked like someone in black. The police office described a gentleman wearing old-fashioned clothes. They didn't say this or a monk. And a lot of the witnesses, when you talk to them, there's varying things. People seem to be seeing two types of things, as though it could be one or the other. But that ended up with this sort of imaginary backstory of a lovelorn monk who died because his heart was broken because he couldn't marry the love of his life. But there's no monastery in the area. There's no history of any monastery in the area. Then somebody, because one of the other witnesses claimed, I think it was a workman, they said that they heard and saw children singing and playing around a pylon at late at night, John. That then became, well, they were obviously the victims of a mining disaster. The nearest child mining disaster is nowhere near Stocksbridge. It's not far away, but it's near enough to be nowhere near where this sighting is.
Absolutely.
And so it ended up that now you have less rigorous people who play on these cliches, who claim to see all sorts of things. I mean, I've heard one report of a woman who died in a car crash because she saw a black monk. But if she died in a car crash, how does anybody know what she saw? Because she was on her own. And there's no record of that either. So it's one of those things, John. I mean, it even became known as the most dangerous road in Britain. It's not even in the top 50. You can get all the evidence. It's not. It had a lot of accidents when it first started, but it still didn't make it that bad. And so sometimes we romanticize these, even though we're talking about people passing away and terrifying events and tragic incidents from the past. They seem to have a life of their own. And when I've spoken to other paranormal researchers in the past, John, one of the things we often find difficult is unpicking these additions to famous stories. I mean, you mentioned one about one of the first cases you investigated as a young man up in Scotland, which was ascribed to a Polish sailor. And you would think, well, how's this story started? And it seems to be one of those that a lot of these stories sort of drift into urban myth because they seem to get additional details as the retellings go by.
Yes, but in the case of possibly the Polish sailor and definitely the Pontefract black monk, there is still some phenomena that has to be explained. So yes, you're right. I mean, just to I love the folklore of ghosts, and I love the example you brought up about the lady who saw a black monk and who died in a car crash. So how do we know she saw? Best example of that is, of course, Lady Loverbond, the ghost ship that haunts Goodwin Sands and Tooth Out every 50 years.
Yes.
And the story goes there was a wedding party, but the captain was secretly in love with the bride. Captain and groom had a fight. The boat ran aground and everybody died. It's even better that if you actually look up Lloyd, it's supposed to have happened in 1748. If you look up Lloyd's registry of shipwrecks 1700 to 1750, there's not a mention of it.
Yes.
It's compulsive reading, actually. My librarian hated me forevermore when I went in under the lending library scheme and said, could I have a copy of Lloyd 1700 to 1750?
So one of those you had to wait in a back room and they fetched in some dusty tomes for you to
No, absolutely. But I mean so I think we agree we kind of compartmentalize paranormal experiences. That doesn't mean paranormal experiences aren't there. It's just that we confuse ourselves. I mean, I'd go even further and say a lot, not necessarily all, but a lot of UFO types experiences, certainly ones involving lights in the sky and so on, would probably 70, 80 years ago have been described as something entirely different. In fact, Rendlesham Forest, quite amusingly, or quite interestingly, is not only famous for UFOs, it has had quite a lot of poltergeist activity in the past, and is famous for the Thug Monkey.
Yes.
Which is roughly the closest we're ever going to get to a British Bigfoot. So are there possibly people and possibly areas that trigger off a paranormal experience, either the power to move things or the power to have ESP or the power to possibly conjure up visualizations, much like the old-fashioned shaman used to do in countries without our cultures? Or is there lots of demons, boggarts, fairies, ghosts, poltergeists, and so on? Are there all these types of things running around? Now, when we've had any breakthrough in science, it's always kind of been one theory, not lots and lots of theories. So what I'd ask people is not to definitely agree with me, but to do your research as if it was a possibility at least. Because if there are all these things out there, we don't really know who's causing what, and we're never going to get to the bottom of it.
I think as well, it's intriguing when we look back and you mentioned in one of the chapters of your book some of the influences that have shaped your life and your research, John. Colin Wilson is probably one of the best examples of someone who has wrote some incredible books on a wide variety of topics, covering a vast range of subjects, which is quite surprising when you look back at his bibliography. But for me, I think Wilson was probably one of those investigators in the United Kingdom that seemed to focus on strange phenomena, whereas other people, such as the wonderful Peter Underwood and Harry Price, perhaps, they were nuts and bolts ghost hunters, and nothing really else sort of crossed their paths. Whereas Wilson was was clearly a man of many and varied interests, and therefore he could often look at a case perhaps in a slightly different view of it, rather than the traditional paranormal investigator or ghost hunter John, that he could perhaps sometimes take a step back and think, is it really just poltergeists or a haunting going on here? Are there other things at play? Because along with, say, somebody such as John Keel, who was a very similar sort of theorist in regards to strange phenomenon, they could look at things in a bigger aspect, whereas I think some people would often be sort of constrained by their experience.
Yeah, I mean, Wilson's fascinating, actually, because, Wilson claimed himself to be a philosopher genius, so yes. that's his background. For those who don't know, he started off writing books called About Outsiders, and then people that were romantic dreamers, and then gradually came to the notion of writing about the occult, to which he roughly came to the conclusion, at least initially, that it was that most occult things were caused by something that he termed as Faculty X, or a hidden power within us, we all have the ability to conjure up at either times of stress or danger, or possibly times of contemplation as well. I think he gave a really interesting example. I've forgotten the hunter's name, but he spoke about a hunter who suddenly had an urge to cross a road and walk a different way, a longer route. Then he came back the next day and he actually found the footprints of a tiger in the road where he was taken, even though he didn't hear anything. So obviously danger triggers something off, triggers up heightened sensibility. And Wilson, primarily, at least through most of his books, thought that the most aspects of the paranormal could be conjured up in the same way, until he went to and interviewed the people at East Drive Pontefract.
Yes.
We're back to the black monk again. And then he totally changed his view, which I thought is a bit absurd. In one case, he only heard about secondhand. Based on the notion as to whether Diane Pritchard could possibly have been pulled up the stairs by her hair, by her subconscious. And I've got a little bit of sympathy, but as there's been various ways that story has been told, I think everyone agrees it was in part light anyway. I wouldn't throw an entire theory, and in effect, tens of thousands of pages of work, because Colin Wilson did write a lot of books, yeah, out on one second-hand piece of evidence. I'd let it challenge your belief that he went from literally believing in a power within us to believing in demons and pixies and boggarts and so on.
Yes. Well, I suppose if any case was going to trip me up, Pontefract would have been one of them, because it's a very strange case, full of some strange, and I must admit, there's a couple of my favourite sort of paranormal events included in that particular case, John, as well, that make me chuckle more than anything, because it seemed whatever was at play had a deep sense of mischief, as well as obviously causing a lot of disturbing aspects to it for the family involved, of course.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a fascinating case. There's no doubt about it. It's even more fascinating that it went away for 30 years until somebody made a film about it and then bought the house. I'm not actually being flippant.
Yes.
Because I've been to Pontefract and saw absolutely nothing, but my sceptical colleagues who stayed a day longer had a lot of fun the second night, bangs and crashes in a particular bedroom. I'm kind of wondering if Pontefract and possibly other houses that are commercially let out for paranormal investigation are not, in effect, a replica of the Philip experiment.
Yes.
In which people, the Philip experiment, for people who aren't aware about it, is an experiment in the 1970s in Canada when people invented a ghostly entity, literally through storytelling, gave it a name, Philip the Cavalier, had a wife, had a mistress. The wife committed suicide after finding out about the mistress. You know, it's they invented, in effect, a wonderful ghost story. But then when they started talking to Philip, who didn't exist, tables started to move, objects started to move. Philip, I think, started communicating with them. And it can't be Philip, because he doesn't exist.
Mm.
You could come up with a far-fetched, with a complex theory at least, that it's some other mischievous goblin, bogger, demon, or what have you, intervening and pretending to be Philip. You'd think, you'd hope they have better things to do. That's not impossible.
Mm.
But surely the simplest thing is we can create our own our own powers through a process of meditation, belief, the right circumstances, and possibly the right place as well.
Mm.
Thus, when people went back to Pontefract, knowing it was a particularly haunted place, they possibly had the same effect.
Mm.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
How would you view a case, for example, John, such as Doddleston from the 1980s? Because that's one that's always intrigued me, because I spoke to Ken when the book was re-released a couple of years ago, because it's always fascinated me since I first read about it in the mid-80s.
Here am I, supposedly the font of all knowledge. I don't know the Doddleston case.
Right, that's okay. So Doddleston is about a man and his wife and a friend of theirs. They were living in a house. Doddleston is in Cheshire. And he borrowed a BBC computer from work. He was a school teacher. And they'd had some strange occurrences. They'd bought a very old house and they were doing it up. I'm trying to think if it was an old stable block or something, John. And so they were doing it up. And they were having weird things, like tins of food were being piled up on the floor and bottles. Footprints were appearing on the wall and the ceiling. And they'd got some kind of weird setup. There was like a studio in the top floor while they were doing the downstairs up. And so at first they kind of put it off as practical jokes or people mucking about. But then they started getting messages on this BBC Micro, which obviously 1985, it's not connected to the internet, which were allegedly from somebody in the rain, I believe. It's been a few months since I read it again. Some sort of Elizabethan Tudor-era person who seemed to be communicating with Ken and his family through this BBC Micro. And they were basically leaving files for each other and talking about it. And it went on for quite a while. And clearly, Ken had been quite burned by the experience of the 80s, because when I reached out to him, he very openly told me that the reason he'd re-released the book, he'd updated it, but he also was sick to death of people selling copies of it on eBay for £300, because it was one of those books that was so hard to get hold of a really good copy. And so he re-released it essentially to kill that market, because he was fed up with people profiting off his book and him not seeing anything. So obviously he re-released it with an updated. So I reached out to him and we had a very nice and very cordial conversation. but he didn't want to do any press because of how he'd been treated. Basically, he was just called an outright liar, John.
Yeah.
But he also said, I've been listening to the show for the last couple of years and I wish you the very best. And that was quite humbling. So he clearly knew enough about me to know that I wouldn't be trying to stitch him up or anything, but he was still so raw from what happened to him 40 years previously that he didn't want to come out and sort of raise his head above the parapet other than re-releasing the book into the wider world. And so it's an intriguing case because people have just basically dismissed it because the language being used, they were saying there wasn't really any kind of contemporary examples that would match how people spoke in that particular period. And also it wasn't good enough to be a fake because the language wasn't clever enough to show that somebody had a real knowledge of Old English, if that makes sense. And so people just said, well, it's just a very bad hoax.
No, it's from what you've said, it sounds a very interesting case. I mean, the first thing one has to question in any such case as that, again, is whatever was happening, is it really coming from an Elizabethan with IT skills?
Yes.
Now that's not being that is being flippant because I do that sometimes, but it's not being flippant about the case itself. Everyone is judging, from the sounds of it, everyone is judging that not on the phenomena, but as to whether or not it is indeed an Elizabethan trying to communicate. And I was a little bit flippant about IT skills, but I mean, quite how poltergeists are supposed to, or ghosts are supposed to infiltrate a very basic BBC computer from the 1980s. There's no real theory behind that. It's never happened before, never happened again. But once you discard the notion that an Elizabethan is trying to communicate with that person, you still have some very interesting, very traditional poltergeist phenomena. I'm particularly interested in the tins being piled up and so on. That actually happened with cushions in the Cage St. Oise, which is a more recent case.
Yes.
Which again was possibly incorrectly identified as being the entity of a witch.
Mm.
So in some ways, giving the phenomena an identity undermines the phenomena itself.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not obviously totally aware of the case you mentioned, but in the case of the Cage, which I did investigate a lot more thoroughly, it was obviously it was an old lockup which was converted into a house, which was lived in, and various people, especially the owner, did have some quite impressive sounding phenomena. Mainly poltergeist stuff like doors banging and so on, people getting pushed, but also the odd apparition.
Mm-hmm.
Where it got its secondary identity was because it was rumoured. In fact, there was a plaque on the wall of the old lockup that had been there for years, claiming it was where a witch, Ursula Kemp, had been interred prior to being hung. And the age of the building makes it well nigh impossible. Ursula was hanged in the 16th century. This is almost certainly an early, late 18th century building at best.
Mm.
And because of this history plaque on the wall, which wasn't put there by the owner, probably put there when it was converted into a dwelling in the 1970s. In effect, you've got people pre-primed and ready to possibly tune in to whatever part of their minds expects something to happen, and whatever part of their mind may possibly make something happen.
Mm. Yes. Well, just before I do that, I didn't want to do it while you were talking, John. I've sent you the link for the book on there, so you can have a look at that afterwards, my friend, for the Doddleston case.
I shall definitely have a look. As I say, ever since you mentioned it was £300 a copy, I kind of realised why I might have overlooked it. But
yeah, it's a lot better price these days, and I have to say it's definitely worth reading if nothing else.
Absolutely.
One of the things about this is, like you say, I think often when you've got certain places, this is the thing when people say that they're investigating certain locations and it's supposed to be the scariest place, or there's certain notorious locations around the world, John, you're already going there pre-primed. Whether you want to believe it or not, you already know what is supposed to occur in these locations. And therefore, some people would suggest that perhaps people are more open to suggestion. They may misinterpret random things because they're expecting strange things to happen. It also depends on, do they know anything about the location? Do they know anything about strange animals? I mean, I've heard fox cries put forward as disembodied spirits. And I think that why do we not check these things before we release them into the world saying this is proof? And I think sometimes it's quite frustrating that people sometimes don't take a step back and think, hang on a minute, why am I coming to this location? Well, I'm coming to this location because of such an experience has been reported over the years. It's very difficult to disentangle your subconscious from that predisposition of what may happen, is it not?
It's absolutely impossible to do that. But by definition, when you go into a reputedly haunted house, you're far more primed up with an expectation of something happening. I'd suggest, though, that expectation can work two ways. First of all, it can make a shadow at the corner of your eye look like a black monk. In which case the skeptics have an absolutely genuine point. But what the skeptics can't explain is if you get more objective phenomena such as movable objects, of moving objects, which are clearly seen to be in one place at one time and then another place at another time. But I take this suggestion thing even further, because the most suggestible state of all you can possibly have is hypnotist. In fact, some years back, I actually indulged in some hypnotic regression experiments. Well, because I was such a poor subject, somebody thought it I'd be better suited actually trying to hypnotize a person under careful supervision. And now, roughly what we came up with most of the better cases was people going into past lives and obviously in a very suggestible state, by its definition, and coming up with a lot of detail, most of which afterwards was proved to be totally inaccurate. But, give you an example of why there's a but. There was a particular hypnotic subject that was taken back into somebody that went to Cardiff University and then fought in World War I, where he was subsequently killed. Now, that person came up with the details of his officers, his regiment, his own name, and so on. All of that didn't seem to exist. And I mean, there's very good records for soldiers and so on in the First World War. However, he also came up with some very interesting details about his walk through Cardiff to the college, which is a town he had never been in. and he'd never been to Cardiff, but the one of the main organisers of the group had lived there for a considerable period of time and knew the place backwards. So Diz having a particular state of suggestibility, a particular state of consciousness, possibly also open the mind to different powers, such as ESP. And if it can do that, maybe it can also open the mind to the powers that can sometimes move objects. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should be taking people in to places in a suggestible state, but discounting any subjective phenomena, i.e. if one person sees something, unless you've got lots of witnesses or something on camera, you can probably, whether or not they actually saw it, it's not proof because there are so many other psychological explanations for it. But if we're to concentrate on the objective phenomena, I'd actually say getting some people into a suggestible state of mind might actually be a good thing to let the objective phenomena occur.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it's one of those things. I think often you can throw the baby out with the bathwater, as the saying goes, John, but you can dismiss these things. I think if you let certain people sort of take over the narrative, you can see some these sort of self-perpetuating stories that they create, which often sound brilliant at the time, but when you start to dig into them, it doesn't make sense, or there's no evidence to support it. It's just sort of, once again, a cliched story, often, you know, broken-hearted young women, children who die in tragic circumstances, drunken old men causing problems. You can see a lot of it. I watched a program recently because I think sometimes, even if certain types of paranormal television can get under your skin in the wrong way, I think it's good to see what is being put out there as alleged phenomenon, because you can't really discuss it without seeing it firsthand, I think, often, John. And I watched a recent episode where essentially they created a story about a child being murdered in a house that had no factual evidence to support it at all. But at the end of the program, that was the evidence. It was the murderer and the murdered child that were haunting this particular location. There was no evidence to suggest that there had been any murder in this particular location at all. But that is what they had decided by creating a story based on very loose factual things and coincidence.
Well, that's really so typical. I was working on a case a couple of years back, a historic case, can't reveal the place or what have you. There was an incident, an ongoing incident of several years, of a stone-throwing entity. They brought at one point, a medium in who claimed there was a child who had drowned in the outside well. And it does seem as if people let their romantic side get the better of them. I mean, going all the way back to the Fox sisters, I mean, that was, if I remember, I think they had a peddler who was buried in the cellar. In the Andover case investigated by my colleague in the SBR, Barry Colvin, I think Communications claimed that there was a man buried in the cellar. It's as if when you open up your subconscious mind, there's a kind of mischievous romantic side that kind of conjures up all these stories. But then again, you do still have phenomena. So maybe you just have to separate the stories from the actual phenomena and concentrate on the phenomena itself. And if you're separating the stories out, you then get rid of a lot of the boxes, a lot of the black monks, the boggarts, the even the possibly the spiritualist box itself, although that's not certain. And you're just left with an undiagnosed power, which is kind of where my book sort of alludes to. One Big Box of Paranormal Tricks, of course, but not in a doctrinal way, in a way that kind of hopefully makes somebody think about the possibility. It's what I'd call a meditation rather than an indoctrination about the subject.
Well, I think this is it, John. What I always enjoy about your writing and your work is that you don't try to tell us what you think it is. You leave it very open-ended for us to try and sort of pull our own opinions to it. Whilst you'll give us your interpretation of certain events, you're not one of those people that says it is definitely this, it is definitely that. And I think when you look at certain cases, and especially these days, people will straight away say it is this, it is that. And sometimes you think, well, half the time you're using things that have no scientific relevance, because you're using widgets, gadgets and all sorts that don't prove anything other than the fact that it can register an electronic frequency bouncing around from anything half the time. And I know I've heard you speak before, one of the interesting aspects sometimes of potential poltergeist cases is that people often say it's a lot of electrical interference, or, you know, power lines or such like, depending on a property's location. But then you would think that surely if we are living in this era of houses having 3, 4, 5 televisions per household, John, and mobile phones and streaming services and games consoles and robotic vacuum cleaners and all sorts, the amount of electrical energy that must be bouncing around a modern home must be far superior to situations like you mentioned there earlier, like Pontefract or Enfield or anything like that, because often these people didn't have a lot of money anyway. So if they had anything, they probably had a television, a fridge and a radio. That would be it. Whereas these days, you know, and I say this for myself, sometimes you can't get away from the amount of cluttering electrical items that everybody has these days. Surely there should be more poltergeist cases if it's just something as simple as electronic interference, no?
I wouldn't discount environmental factors from assisting, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've actually been partly investigating a case recently where they must have had about 7 TVs, so that's probably quite a good example. But I mean, there did seem to be a potential correlation between certain environmental factors, possibly certain levels of electromagnetic frequency and possible paranormal occurrences. I think my colleague in the SBR, Steve Parsons, found an excellent one in, sorry for all your listeners, another confidential case in a Welsh farmhouse. So at least we can go as far as saying it's a Welsh farmhouse. It's mm-hmm. quite well written up, actually.
Yes.
If anyone wants to Google it, where they did actually find that the main room where poltergeist activity was taking place was basically had huge electrical faults and was sending their sophisticated EMF readings off the scale.
Mm.
And they also found it was on some kind of geological fault. And this was objective poltergeist-style phenomena, you know, I think children's toys being chucked across the room and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And then when you start to think about, if one goes back a little bit in time to the 1980s and Paul Devereux's theories of earth lights and happening in geological faults, you do start to get the possibility of a correlation that there might be particular places that can help to trigger off experiences from particular people in a particular state of mind. Might come from the person, but the place could act as a catalyst. Thus, you have your haunted house. It's not haunted per se, but it's set up in such a way that certain people may tend to have paranormal type experiences there. I wish when I had done my detailed investigation of the cage, we'd given it a really thorough, you know, a really thorough EMF thing. We could not, unfortunately, get the suitably trained experts, of which there's only very few around the country in. But that would have been particularly interesting. And that is a particular skill that I wish more paranormal researchers had. We do need to get more physicists, more scientists involved just to do proper baseline readings and to try to see if there is any correlation between environment and effect.
Absolutely. And there are numerous stories from all around the world of people who seem to have bad luck when it comes to electrical appliances, John. It's almost as if they can blow them up. People's televisions always break, or they can't wear a wristwatch for some reason, or they get headaches whenever the microwave's on or something like that. Everybody's different. And so there is always a certain level of electricity running through people, through brain waves or whatever, that can sometimes, maybe depending on how people live their lives or their genetic makeup, whatever, there are some people that have strange effects when it comes to electrical items. And we all, I'm sure, have had that experience of shaking somebody's hand or brushing against somebody and getting a static charge from them. And so it makes you wonder sometimes, are there these people that act like batteries, where that is basically they don't particularly feel anything's going wrong, but anything around them that works on electrical current reacts in a negative way because that person is a charged battery, essentially.
I certainly wouldn't discount that at all. I mean, there's, I think it's the Rosenheim case in Germany where a lady would basically walk into the office and blow the light bulbs. It actually happened after the lady had had her engagement broken off. So it was probably in a stressed state of mind and had apparently amazing electrical effects in the environment around her, as well as moving filing cabinets. So, I think that's entirely possible. I don't think there's anything wrong with, to be honest, measuring anything, so long as you're a temperature, electromagnetism, some people even carry around Geiger counters, so long as you're aware that you're only measuring what you're measuring. Now, obviously, if you do it often enough and every haunted place you go to tends to be radioactive, you could then construct a theory either about radioactivity causing a real paranormal event or radioactivity firing the mind and causing hallucinations. But that was just an example of the way equipment can and should be used. But you do not go into a potentially haunted house thinking you have a ghost detector, because we don't know for sure what a ghost or a poltergeist is, and you can't detect what you don't know what it is yet. That's basic science.
Yes.
So no, I mean, I don't mind people using equipment at all. Actually, in fact, that little bit of it, we were going back to The Exorcist. That little bit of equipment that's very controversial, known as the Ouija board, was a child's toy until The Exorcist came along. Yes. Now it is a portal to evil. It is a bit of wood which can attune the subconscious to various things. Nothing more, nothing less. It's probably no different to a crystal ball or holding hands in a circle or any other technique for opening up the conscious mind. Quite why it's got such a bad press is probably, actually, I take that back a little bit, it's probably due to people's expectations now, because it's thought as being evil, you're more likely to subconsciously think you are being taken over by something evil, so therefore it's best avoided by anyone who does think it's evil. Yes. It gets very complicated in some ways, but yeah. but yes, it's I'm not recommending you all go to you all go to haunted houses with Ouija boards, by the way. I was just pointing out that until 50 years ago it was thought of as just another tool of the trade, or even as a children's toy. In fact, I think Parker Brothers used to make a foldable Ouija board.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yes. Well, if you go to the wonderful Museum of Witchcraft in Edinburgh, they've got a wonderful display of them, of Ouija boards, like you say, John, and they go back about 100 years, I think, in the States. And you can see the different variations that have been released over the years. And yeah, it's, you know, it's clearly advertised as a toy. But it is, The Exorcist is one of those things. It completely changed how people view them. And you still see it occasionally pop up in numerous horror films, that the Ouija board is the gateway to summoning darkness, be it Witch Board from the 80s to Paranormal Activity in the noughties. There are numerous films that have always fallen back on that gateway to letting in darkness is through people mucking about with a Ouija board.
Absolutely. It's again because the Ouija board is now thought of as being that, perhaps it's best avoided by people who think of it as being that, because if you do open your mind, you are liable to at least assume anything paranormal that opening your mind triggers is caused by something evil, and that's not a terribly pleasant experience. Probably not best carried around, to be honest. Apart from everything else, if you're dealing with a private household, it would scare them nearly as much as calling yourself a demonologist.
Yes.
But I think it's all just examples of how we do compartmentalize things, you know, as my book kind of says. What is the Ouija board tapping into that a conventional seance or a medium getting themselves into a trance isn't tapping into? It's surely just one and the same. I mean, is there any difference between Aleister Crowley, who communicated with his guardian angel Awas and wrote his Book of the Law through automatic writing in, I think, 2 hours, or from the medium, spiritualist medium, Rosemary Brown, who communicated through more conventional spiritualistic ways with dead composers such as Schubert and Liszt, and automatically wrote concertos in the style of those composers. Are we really saying that Aleister Crowley and Rosemary Brown were doing entirely different things? I think they'd hate to admit it because they come from such different traditions.
Yes.
But that's the sort of thing my One Big Box book points out. You've got different traditions, but at the end of the day, very similar phenomena. I mean, other example of automatic writing. Matthew Manning started off as a conventional boy who was having poltergeist incidents, became an internationally acclaimed healer, and in between times had bouts of automatic writing in Greek and Arabic, which he had very little knowledge of. He identified it as being through spirits, but I love the description he gave about it in his book, because it sounded very much to me like some kind of form of self-hypnosis.
Mm.
And as I say, we use hypnotism to try to conjure up ESP and what have you. So why are we looking for all different types of entities when the cause might be within us? And that's not really a cop-out. That's something really special.
Mm.
That's definitely something off the normal spectrum. It's definitely something paranormal.
Mm. Yes. Well, there's one other subject I'd like to tackle before as time has already flown, John, through us having a chat. I'm never been so disappointed when I read a section in a book and thought, if only, was reading about your experiences delving into the Highgate Vampire, because this case has always fascinated me on a variety of levels, John, because firstly, it's just got two very different characters leading it, David Farrant and the Reverend Sean Manchester. It's one of those stories, I think, sometimes, especially when I speak to anybody who's not British or is not that well versed with older sort of paranormal occult goings on in the United Kingdom prior to the 80s, often, that it seems very hard to believe for many people that there was this flap of alleged vampirism running about in Highgate Cemetery in London. But it shows you how quickly something can catch fire, I think, because it's such a strange story with numerous different strands connecting it. And to read that you and your friend, when you were younger, decided to try and make a documentary about it, only to be torpedoed by your family's musical predilections and taping over all your interviews. I'm really fascinated, John, because I've not spoken to anybody really previously who had a sort of first-hand experience, because you went and interviewed witnesses and you went to the location, you went about, yes, I appreciate it was several years after the initial flap of it all occurring, but it's still a crazy case, which I think, because of the people that gatekeep the information in regards to this particular case, it doesn't seem like we'll ever really get a really good overview of it, because both sides have very different versions of the truth.
They do indeed. Just to briefly give a little bit of context as to what you're talking about. Yes, when I was about 15, now people of a certain age might remember Don Craven's News Round. They used to have a young filmmakers competition, as I was already rather besotted by the paranormal, I got my Super 8, and a photographer friend of mine, who wasn't interested in the paranormal but liked the idea, yes, we went to a couple of places. I think it was called, one was the Silent Pool Shear and one was Highgate Cemetery. In the great tradition of not doing one's research when one's 15. I was actually in the new cemetery rather than the old cemetery, and the old cemetery is where all the fun happened. But we did get some interesting interviews from people that knew secondhand about the phenomena, and then put in those days you only really had silent Super 8, so you were allowed to superimpose a cassette tape. I will let those that don't know what a cassette tape is Google it. At the same time, an unnamed member of my family, who I'm never quite sure who it was very much into the top 30, and I think accidentally obliterated my witness testimony with the Bay City Rollers. I think we've all done crazy, amusing things in the paranormal, and yes, the One Big Box book does go into some of the crazy, amusing things as well. However, you are right about the Highgate case. It's absolutely fascinating, and never had the pleasure of talking to the Reverend Manchester. I did, however, run into David Farrant a few times.
Oh.
In fact, I actually went to his funeral when he sadly passed away. Yeah. And he was very much of the view that what he had seen was a ghost.
Hmm.
I think he described it as a 6 foot tall gentleman in an old, you know, oldie worldy clothes, which, you know, might fit into Bram Stoker's idea of what a vampire was, but could it just as easily have been a 6 foot tall gentleman in oldie worldy clothes.
Hmm.
He kind of possibly admits he was actually a very shy gentleman, funnily enough, but he kind of possibly admits he possibly got carried away by the Sunday tabloids and what have you. So certainly in later life he didn't think of it as a vampire case at all. Now other people have different opinions on it. I totally respect that. There's been far too much stress caused by that case when it should have just been a straightforward case. There's also been a lot of press generated mythology by newspapers that should know better, and probably didn't help that about 150 members of the public were trying to climb the cemetery gates in 1973, I think, to slay the vampire. It's a story that got a whole afterlife or everlasting afterlife of its own, which at least one of the main parties thought of as a ghost. So, I mean, we don't have vampires, in my opinion, in the UK, because we don't have any traditions, and anything that's seen as supernatural and evil can't be vampires, because vampires are incorruptibles, and the whole Western tradition of Christianity think of incorruptibles as being saints.
Mm.
But the Christian Orthodox Church thinks of incorruptibles as evil. It's one of the main differences, actually.
Yes.
So we have no real tradition of incorruptibles as being creatures of the night and evil unknown things, because they're far too saintly.
Yes.
Bar Croglan Hall, which is probably an after dinner story.
Yes.
And Highgate, which is Highgate. We have very little tradition in the vampire box, which probably goes to show we invent our own boxes for what is possibly one paranormal power.
Yes. I remember my first experience to Highgate was I listened to an interview Sean Manchester gave on Halloween 1990 on Radio 1, John. When Nicky Campbell was a DJ on that particular show, and he had the evening session, and so he would normally mix it up with music, but you could clearly he was sort of positioning himself into more of a sort of conversationalist rather than a radio music DJ. And I remember being laid in bed listening to this conversation, and I just couldn't get my head around it because it was the first time I'd ever heard anything about it. And he was speaking to a guy who was telling this story about these vampires and all this that had happened 20 years earlier. And I was just absolutely enthralled by it. I mean, obviously, what I know now is very different to what I heard when I was an 18-year-old man listening to it on a dark, stormy Halloween in 1990. But it's a story that's always really, I don't know, I've always had a lot of time for it, primarily because it's such a strange case with so many layers and all this, you know, this posse of the general public turning up with forks and sticks and all sorts, and some of the weird little foibles like Ferrant gets arrested for trespassing and gets off with it because there's no law against staking a corpse.
I believe the judge in question was called Christopher Lee.
Yes.
If that's not putting synchronicity to the extreme, I don't know. And I mean Peter Underwood very much wrote about the Highgate vampire case roughly as it was reported at the time. So he must have thought at least it had some validity. Mm. So you mentioned Underwood and Price and obviously Colin Wilson earlier. But we're never going to quite get to the truth of it. But lots of paranormal cases, whatever they would be, do sometimes have that special afterlife of their own. And certainly Highgate is one of the finest in that respect. It's got a whole mythology of itself, and there's been arguments and there's been all kinds of things related to it. Yeah. It's probably because, taken even slightly at face value, it's a wonderful story.
Absolutely. Like you mentioned about the judge being called Christopher Lee, I always liked the fact that one of the original witnesses' surname was Moriarty as well, John. It was almost too good to be true.
Maybe there was something paranormal going on that we don't quite understand. I didn't actually know that bit. But if that's the case as well, I mean, Christopher Lee, you can just about get over because it's not that common. Yes. But, you know, I mean, Moriarty.
Well, I suppose, John, before we depart for today's conversation, how has it been when you write a book like this, do you find that you are adapting or your thoughts change in regards to how you view a particular subject post and pre-book? When you go into it, you think, right, this is what I'm going to try and focus on and tackle and look at and give people and the reader an insight to. And then come out of it at the other end and think, actually, that's a very different book to what I thought it was going to be.
Yes, no. No, in the sense that it would be tricky to present a book called One Big Box of Paranormal Tricks to a publisher and then end up writing about something that doesn't roughly come to that conclusion. Mm. The title was slightly adapted along the way, but for different reasons.
Yes.
And I always actually have a picture in my head about what each chapter is going to be called and let the book develop from there. So, and if I started off with a potentially different paranormal theory and then decided halfway through there wasn't one, I wouldn't have much to write about. But saying that, I do adapt my views as I write. I've even adapted, I mean, my book very much tries to fit a lot of ufology into more traditional supernatural encounters, and I do still believe there's a complete overlap. I've actually done research since that actually makes me think there is actually a reasonable fighting chance some UFO encounters are actually what it says in the tin, you know, possibly aliens from another, from somewhere else. So my views are continually adapting, but I probably start a book with a premise rather than having a continual argument with myself, because otherwise there wouldn't really be a book at the end of it or a conclusion at the end of it. But I usually have an idea before I write a book is probably the best way of putting it. Yes.
Excellent. Well, one last point. Obviously, you're still a member of the Spontaneous Cases Committee, John?
I'm still very much a member of the Spontaneous Cases Committee of the Society for Psychical Research, yeah.
So have you had anything land on your doorstep in recent? Because it's been, whilst it may not seem that long, it's been 18 months since we spoke. So has anything sort of pulled you into the investigation through that in that period?
We have one or two interesting cases on the go. I think I alluded to a place that did have at least six or seven TVs in the building, which a lot of coins have spontaneously been thrown about in. But sadly, because of the nature, most of the work we do is confidential. Mm-hmm. I would hope actually that most groups have the same standard, unless somebody's particularly crying out for publicity, it's confidential. So phenomena might be a lot more common than we actually believe. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's goodness knows how many paranormal groups going around at the moment. Some taking it fairly seriously and some, having a very professional approach. It would be good if we could somehow share the stuff that we can't talk about publicly, because obviously if you're dealing with somebody's private home, the residents need to come first. But it would be good if we could find a sort of central point of comparing notes so we can actually see if there are these correlations, if people are taking EMF readings and finding something that might be similar and so on. But unfortunately, we don't have quite that central body in paranormal research to do that. They're usually called universities. And even though about seven or eight universities do have parapsychology departments, they're not yet geared up in the same way for spontaneous cases.
Mm.
But that's something I would hope we have in the future.
Tantalising as always, John. Thank you, sir. So, my friend, before I let you leave, where can everybody get a hold of this most recent book and any of your previous works and keep up to date with what you've got going on online, sir?
The book we've been talking about is called, very long title, Paranormal Perspectives, because it's part of a series. You have other people writing about their own paranormal perspectives. One Big Box of Paranormal Tricks, from Ghosts to Poltergeist to the Theory of Just One Paranormal Power. Forgive the long title. You can find it easily through Amazon via John Fraser, One Big Box of Paranormal Tricks, if your search engine isn't very efficient. It's obviously available on Amazon, most other online bookstores, probably some specialist bookshops. Kindle, and so on. It's, as I say, what I would call a meditation on the subject. In fact, I kind of ran out of subtitle. I'd also call it, I also kind of subtitle it Zen and the Art of Spending the Night in a Haunted House. It's not a scientific book. It's a book that might make you think. It's got a bit of philosophy, even a little bit of religion.
Well, thank you as always, John. It's a pleasure speaking with you again. I always look forward to conversations, so I was very excited when you messaged me to say you got a new book coming out. So I just want to say thank you again. We've had a rollicking good conversation. Time has flown by, sir, and I think we've covered a vast array of thoughts and topics and cases throughout that period. And I just want to say, as always, thank you for your time today. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you again, Paul.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.